Brazil, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets on Saturday, demanding the impeachment of the dreaded Bolsonaro. The nationwide protests coincided with the announcement that Brazil has now passed the tragic milestone of 500,000 deaths from COVID, a record exceeded only by the US of A. Now, on the Little Wireless program, we've been back and forth to Brazil since he got elected in October 2018, and it's beginning to sound, like Groundhog Day. An escalating public health crisis, a plummeting economy, a president who survived a number of corruption scandals, now facing a Senate inquiry. Time to call back the Economist Brazil correspondent, Sarah Maslin, to try and make sense of it all as only Sarah can. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hello, it's really good to be back.
I understand it's been Bolsonaro supporters who've been out on the streets parading on motorbikes. How significant was this weekend's turnout of anti-Bolsonaro protesters?
This does feel like a change, what you're seeing in the streets in the past couple of weeks. For most of the pandemic, indeed from the very beginning, what you saw on almost a weekly basis were these car parades, motorcycle parades, and even, you know, crowds of people on foot in the streets supporting the president and demanding that governors and mayors open everything up, because that's what Bolsonaro has been saying from the very beginning in a very Trump way, that you have to put the economy first and poverty and hunger are worse than the virus and all of this social distancing and masks and vaccines and all of that is nonsense. And so that was really what you were seeing in the streets, were people supporting him. That has changed just in the past few weeks. So we saw at the end of May one big protest against Bolsonaro, the very first one, when people finally, you know, with masks, agreed it's worth it to take the risk because there still really is a lot of virus here and not a lot of people are vaccinated. Something like 15% of adults have been vaccinated in Brazil, but people went into the streets anyway, and they did that again just a few days ago in even bigger numbers, with even more furious calls for Bolsonaro to resign, which of course he's not going to do, or be impeached by Congress.
It's interesting that protesters took to the streets in over 200 towns and cities, and this time, instead of banging pots and pans outside their houses, they were carrying banners accusing the government of genocide.
That's right. That's right. And you really see this anger that people are feeling. And, you know, before that was expressed on social media and with pots and pans out of the windows. But there is kind of a sense that Brazilians just have had it and they need to do something bigger. And they're now going into streets. And that word genocide, I mean, what you're seeing is a country that feels totally helpless in the face of a pandemic that's going on, 15 months now. And whereas at the beginning, I think Brazilians felt like they were in the same boat as the rest of the world, scared and, stuck inside. Now, what people are feeling is they're looking at the TV and seeing people going back to normal. The U.S. has stripped away its mask guidelines. Even other Latin American countries have really done better with vaccinating people. But here in Brazil, things are going so slowly, and there's this inquiry into Bolsonaro going along in the Senate that's revealing that Bolsonaro actually had a lot of chances going back 6-7 months to buy vaccines, and he ignored them. He didn't reply to the emails. He made jokes about vaccines turning people into crocodiles. He kind of did everything other than the smart, logical public health path, and people are really mad about that.
Now, we know the geography of the protest pretty much everywhere. What about the demography of it? What sort of people are protesting? All ages, all social levels?
You're seeing a little bit of everything. I think, from what I've seen here in Sao Paulo and the coverage of the protests elsewhere, it definitely is skewing younger and more of a sort of city base. But I think that you know, as the as if these protests continue and as they go on, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how they kind of gain speed. And you saw in some cases kids with their parents, including some parents who maybe voted for Bolsonaro or people who had banners that were sort of repentant. You know, I voted for this guy, but he's betrayed me. And so you're seeing in the polls as well that Bolsonaro had something like 40% approval at one point last year when the government was giving people quite generous for Brazil aid payments for, you know, for the pandemic. And then they've ran out of money to be giving those same payments this year. And so in addition to now the virus still killing people, you also have a real shooting up of poverty and hunger and economic despair. And so the approval rating of Bolsonaro has just sort of plummeted in the past few months.
Now, Brazil is still admitting to around 2,000 deaths daily. And you point out this could rise as winter takes hold. But epidemiologists argue that the real death toll in Brazil may actually be much higher than admitted because of underreporting.
That's right. We actually, at The Economist, have been following this excess death number for more than a year now, looking at burial rates in different places. And Latin America has some of the highest excess deaths of any region in the world. And Brazil is not the highest. If you look at Peru and Mexico, there are some countries that the gap between what's reported and what the real numbers are is even bigger. But it's been a problem here in Brazil as well. Not every person who's dying from COVID is getting reported. And so that number that is now reported at 500,000 could be, you know, much closer to 1 million.
A disproportionate impact on indigenous communities?
That's right as well. And I've spent a bit of time over the past few months traveling to places that were hit really hard. Indigenous people have now mostly been vaccinated, which is a tiny bit of good news. But of course, they weren't in the first wave. And it was just really devastating the way that the virus sort of swept through a lot of indigenous territories in some cases because of pre-existing problems, including that illegal gold miners have been invading these territories and loggers and, you know, people doing all sorts of things that have been damaging to the environment and to indigenous people's, you know, way of life. And then suddenly they're also bringing COVID-19. And so there have been so many really tragic stories on one territory. You know, half a dozen babies died from COVID, which is something that's, you know, extremely tragic and really quite unusual as well.
I'm aware that Brazil has had an India-style problem in that, as well as terrible stresses on the hospitals and a great issue with getting vaccinations. There's also been a widespread oxygen shortage.
That's right. And the oxygen shortage has been acute. There have been a few moments when it's been really scary. And one of those was right kind of at the beginning of what we're calling now the second wave back in late January or early February in Manaus, a city in the Amazon that was the first to see cases really spike at the beginning of the pandemic, mostly because the health system there is so weak. There's so few hospitals, and it actually is a big city of 2 million people in the middle of the Amazon. And then it was also the first city to see a real second wave because of a new variant that is believed to have come from that Amazonian city and is more infectious. And so you saw then people really sadly who had thought that the whole city had some kind of herd immunity, because there were some studies showing that, you know, a huge share of the population had been infected the first time around, which meant people let down their guard. You know, governors and mayors really were hesitant to put in new social distancing policies, even when it really looked like things were spiking again. And then they were hit with this new variant. And so you get to the end of January after the Christmas holidays and hospitals are running out of oxygen.
Sarah, when you came on the program over a year ago, there was clear signals that Bolsonaro was going to downplay the pandemic. How much has this, the message from the man at the top, contributed to that death toll in your view?
Well, this is the million-dollar question. Of course, you can't blame him for all of the deaths, but I think it really has contributed a lot. And, you know, there have even been some studies recently looking at, well, if he had signed this vaccine contract back when it was offered in, you know, in September or October, that could have saved, one study said, around 90,000, 95,000 people, because, you know, these were people who would have been vaccinated then by the time this second wave came around. But, I mean, I think also you have to kind of be here to feel the extent to which the pandemic hasn't kind of fully set in a lot of ways. I went into the supermarket just a couple nights ago, and the mask that was being offered was a piece of paper that had been cut out into a mask shape with little holes on the ears. And so this, you know, they're really, this country kind of, in a lot of ways, heard Bolsonaro say that this isn't something to worry about and took that to heart. And of course, you have lots of people who are terrified and who have been doing everything they can. But, you know, there's a lot of people also who are with Bolsonaro in his denialist boat. And that has been devastating.
I remember all his Trumpian references to COVID as a little flu or a bad case of the sniffles and the way he shrugged off the death toll by saying, well, we'll all die one day. He's been a very naughty boy.
Yeah, that's for sure. He really hasn't changed the message. I mean, now he's finally starting to boast that, you know, actually his government is the one that's making sure that people get vaccines in their arms, and he's been doing that all along. But it does really feel like a kind of a last-ditch attempt, because he's, you know, now being investigated and is seeing the way that his popularity has plummeted. And the next day he'll go out and say something about the vaccine possibly being dangerous again. And so there hasn't been much change from him.
How much clout does the Senate investigation have, Sarah?
Well, that's a good question. These kind of investigations can lead to impeachment. They have led to impeachment in the past, most recently with the corruption investigation of the state oil firm Petrobras, that was one thing that contributed to the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff. But in this case, Bolsonaro still has support in Congress. In the middle of the pandemic last year, when he was also really feeling vulnerable because of a couple of corruption investigations into his sons, he signed an alliance, made a deal with this big kind of amorphous group of congressional parties called the Central, which literally means big center. For the most part, these are parties that function on pork and patronage, jobs and money to do projects in their home states that'll get them elected again. And this has been his main base for, you know, about a year now. And it looks like they are probably using this investigation to weaken him and you know, get more out of him, shake him up for more, but not necessarily to impeach him.
Nonetheless, impeachment is at least remotely possible. What about Lula? How's his chance of a comeback?
Well, that is really what the kind of most obvious consequence of this investigation and the pressure that Bolsonaro is feeling now is it strengthens Lula and it weakens Bolsonaro in the lead up to an election in 2022 that really does feel like it's already at the doorstep. Lula was not allowed to run the last time around. He has now been absolved of the corruption charges that had barred him the last time because the Supreme Court decided that the judge that convicted him was biased. And so now he's free to run and has suggested he will run. And, you know, the current polls show that he would win. That could change, though. Bolsonaro has still more than a year to regain ground. And if there's one thing that we've learned about Bolsonaro, he's extremely resilient and is able to often turn what seems like a disaster into something that supports him. And he did that last year with these emergency aid payments. His popularity went up after the worst, you know, beginning of the pandemic rather than going down. So he could try to do something like that, populist measures that bring in votes.
Finally, Donald Trump, Donald Bone Spurs Trump, is not a former army captain like Bolsonaro. How significant is his support from the military?
I wish I could tell you the answer, and we all wish that we knew the answer. He certainly has a lot of military generals, some active and some retired, in his cabinet, and has hired around 6,000 people from the military in different places in the government. And there's a question of if he were to lose and pull a kind of stunt like Trump pulled at the Capitol and tried to get his supporters out into the streets and say that he'd actually won and people should defend the victory, how would the police and the army react?
Well, on that tantalizing question, I must take my leave from you, Sarah, but thanks immensely for coming on again. Sarah Maslin, the Brazil correspondent for The Economist, LNL on RN.